Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So just a couple of quick news tidbits. According to our public health officer, we are on track for opening up, yay, pools and camping. There's some rather elaborate things for the camping, but essentially we're going to put the kids together in cohorts and let them go everywhere together and with the same teachers every day and do cycles. So essentially cocooning, if you will, with the kids to try and keep any major spread from going on. An update on pets. Their new CDC reports say that there is no evidence of spread through pets. A few animals have tested positive for the virus. These could be fragments of virus. It's not clear if they were infectious. Fur is a surface, and just like any other surface, it might briefly harbor virus. You know, just pet the dog or the cat and go wash your hands. And if you wash your hands before you pet the animal, cough into your elbow, and you're not going to give the surface COVID, and you're not going to get the surface COVID from the surface. And you know what? I think that pets are a protective for any kind of infection. They're also a protective for cancer and all-cause mortality. You just have someone who cares about you, something, someone, yeah, but an entity that is alive and wants to cuddle with you. And let me tell you, that's worth a lot healthcare-wise. Oh, it's been a really crazy couple of last 2 weeks, and I was talking to a reporter at the Good Times today, and we were thinking about the enabling factors that COVID has had in maybe leading to the uprisings that we're currently seeing. But while I was wandering around the CDC site with the uprisings in the back of my head, I came across this hospitalization data for COVID-19, national hospitalization data. And it's the number of people hospitalized per 100,000 population. So you see, that takes away the difficulty of comparing because it's divided by 100, it's per 100,000. So Native Americans win, and this is not something you want to win, 167 individuals per 100,000. African Americans, what they call in this on the CDC, non-Hispanic black, have 150 per 100,000. Latino patients are 117 per 100,000. Asian and Pacific Islander, 39. Wow, that's quite a drop. And white, 34. And that started echoing in my head a little bit, thinking about the black male risk of police homicide. There's been a lot of talk about that lately. And if you look it up, it's 2.4 per 100,000, while we're talking about 100,000. Latinos, it's 1.2 per 100,000, and whites was 0.7 per 100,000. And this was in a series of sample years, so this is per year per 100,000 people. It works out to a lifetime risk of about 1 in 1,000 of being killed by police if you're a black male. And that's 2.5 times the risk for white males. So, yeah, I guess your risk of being killed by the police is less than your risk of ending up hospitalized from COVID, relatively speaking, to whites, but it's still a horribly high risk. And we've known for a long time about death statistics from certain kinds of cancer. Prostate cancer, for example. Incidence, which means how many new cases per year. We've got 173 prostate cancer cases per 100,000 black males, and only 97 cases per 100,000
in white males. If you look at prostate cancer deaths, it's 39 per 100,000 for black males and 18, less than half for white males. What about breast cancer? Well, incidence of breast cancer in black females is actually a little bit less, 121 cases per 100,000. It's higher in white women, 125, not by very much. But five-year survival, not the same story. 78% five-year survival for black women with breast cancer and 90% five-year survival for white women with breast cancer. And a lot of this could be attributed to access to health care and quality of the hospitals, but I came upon one article that discussed differences in methylation between black and white women. And I want to scroll down and read this from the results. Many studies have reported about P53 mutated in most African-American breast cancers. Now, P53 is a tumor suppressor gene, and when you mutate it, the cells don't commit suicide even when they're damaged. Ordinarily, the cells are programmed to, when their DNA is severely damaged, to just die. But if you lose P53, that doesn't happen, and some of those cells will go on to become cancer cells. There's another gene that's studied in this article. It's a tumor suppressor gene, and its long name, RASSFIA F1A, it modulates a lot of this cell suicide, and it's also a cell checkpoint pathway. So when a cell is reproducing, there's a pause called a checkpoint, during which the proofreader goes through and double checks that the DNA has been transcribed properly, so that two copies of good DNA go out to each of the daughter cells. But if that particular mechanism is mutated, then you're more likely to get cancer, and the cancer is more likely to be aggressive. Research showed that looking at women under 50 years, that 76% of African-American women had methylation in this important protective gene versus 29% of cases of Caucasian women. And I want to emphasize this about methylation. It's a acquired change. Okay, this is actually cellular learning. It's influenced by in all kinds of environmental factors, including environmental factors which occur in utero, things like diet, sleep, anxiety, and it continues throughout our life, depending on our behavior, how much we drink, what we eat. We methylate differently, and methylation is kind of like, I like to think of it as putting a paperclip on the DNA. Now, maybe you're flagging that DNA to start reproducing or being transcribed. When you methylate the promoter region, you stop the DNA from being transcribed. When the methyl falls off or never happens in the first place, then, oops, now that region's going to be transcribed. So depending upon whether you want the gene or you don't want the gene, like an oncogene, which is present during in utero development but then gets methylated and turned off later on, you don't want to lose that methylation as you go around dividing your cells, or you're more likely to get cancer. This cellular learning, we had a wonderful experiment that went on in, I think it was 2 years ago, when Scott Kelly went and spent, I think it was 2014 or 2015, and he went up and he stayed on the space station for a year. Now, the cool thing is that Scott Kelly has an identical twin brother, Mark, also an astronaut, but he didn't go to the space station. So we had a classic thought experience, and if you wander around the archives from that era, you'll find my discussion of epigenetics and methylation and what the studies showed. But basically, Scott was under a lot of stress, radiation stress. He was eating a very narrow diet, a very different diet. He also wasn't drinking anything, but he had more radiation exposure. And his telomeres, which are an indicator of your longevity, shortened. And some of his methylation changes reversed when he got back, but some of them are still present. So as we listen to people talk about I can't breathe and Black Lives Matter, and we think about what the implications are for the talk and the testimonies that we've been hearing about what it's like to live Black in America, I started asking myself, what is a lifetime of social stressors, anxiety about being stopped and frisked and possibly injured if you ask for help, not to mention food stress and the other structures, poor housing, increased risk of injury, all the other things that are part of growing up disadvantaged in this country. Well, it turns out that these stressors are especially bad if the stressors begin in utero or in childhood. Remember about methylation is cellular learning? Well, we've experimentally induced lifelong anxiety in mice by stressing the mom while she was pregnant with the pups. The data I've already presented about cancer is some of the evidence that our society has perpetuated a similar sort of experiment on an entire segment of our population. Even when you control for income, there are substantial differences in all sorts of adverse pregnancy outcomes. Non-Hispanic Black women are significantly more likely to experience preterm birth. The preterm birth is 12.8% of pregnancies versus 8% for whites, so a 50% increase in premature babies, which drastically increases the risk to the baby and puts the mother through a higher percentage of cesarean sections. Hypertension, also more common, pregnancy-induced hypertension, 16% in African American women, Black women, and 13% in white women. Small for gestational age, in other words, stunted babies, low birth weight babies who have a harder time, spend more time in the ICU and are more at risk for infection. And, of course, more likely to get antibiotics and have a messed up microbiome as a result. 17% versus 8.6% in whites, another almost 50% differential. So what's going on here? These differences do not appear to be explained by differences in demographics. They controlled for income and education in this particular study. They do not appear to be explained by differences in self-reported psychological factors, such as the woman's score on a stress or a depression inventory. But could it actually be adverse childhood experiences? And what do I mean when I talk about adverse childhood experiences? This was a study that was done in the 1980s by Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser has a lot of patients, and they have a lot of information about them. So they gave everyone who participated a questionnaire, and they asked them about adverse childhood experiences. If you want to take the quiz yourself, you can find it online, or you can go look at the Wikipedia article about this, and there's a link. What are we talking about? Any physical abuse, any sexual abuse, any emotional abuse, any physical neglect, any emotional neglect, any exposure to domestic violence, even if it's as a witness, household substance abuse, again, exposure to seeing someone abuse, household mental illness, parental separation or divorce, or an incarcerated household member. Now, that's a long list. And when you take a look at the number of the population who's experienced at least one of them, you'll find that the most common ones are a divorce or a parental separation and a substance abuse disorder. And about two-thirds of individuals have at least one adverse childhood experience. But when you have two or more, your risk of all kinds of health problems goes up. You have a shorter lifespan. You have, well, let's see, the list is just amazing. High-risk health behaviors, of course, you would expect that. Smoking, alcohol, drug abuse, promiscuity, severe obesity. Also increased risks of depression, heart disease, cancer, chronic lung disease, and a shortened lifespan. Compared to a score of 0, having 4 adverse childhood experiences was associated with a 7-fold, 700% increase in alcoholism, a doubling of your risk of being diagnosed with cancer, a 4-fold increase in emphysema, and if you've got an ACE score above 6, you've got a 3,000% increase in attempted suicide for your life. Lots of work has been done on this, and I'm going to share a few studies because I believe that some of the differentials that we saw in the African American population have to do with, you know, if you go granular and you look at what's going on in the DNA. I've already presented work that suggests that what's going on in the DNA is differences in methylation, differences in those very important controls that silence genes or cause them to be transcribed. Let's look at one on breast cancer, which I think is very instructive. We know that childhood adversity produces dysregulation of stress response systems. People have an increased reactivity to stressors that they get during adulthood. They're not as resilient. And this is actually also physiologically apparent. We'll come to that in another subsequent article. But this study looked at whether or not adverse childhood experiences affected survival from breast cancer. So this was a group of women. They had 40 of them. Evaluation was done after breast surgery and continued through, quote, early survivorship. At the initial assessment, women who had childhood emotional neglect or abuse had greater perceived stress from their cancer diagnosis, more fatigue, more depressive symptoms, and a poorer quality of life. But they also had a measurably lower natural killer cell activity. This was coupled with elevated levels of plasma IL-6. IL-6, that may ring a bell for you, because IL-6 is one of the major drivers of that pivot towards cytokine storm. So are we seeing, as these increased hospitalizations in blacks, are we seeing the result of adverse childhood experiences manifesting as higher levels of IL-6? Well, this study would certainly seem to suggest that. Childhood adversity predisposed these women to lower a natural killer cell activity early in their cancer and before they were diagnosed. This is a critical time when this immune effector is the most effective, because if there's any nascent tumor seeding, if there's any precancers that weren't removed by the original surgery, which is often the case because they can't be identified when they're precancers, the childhood adversity makes it more likely that this woman will go on and have a recurrence. Now, I have several women right now that are in my practice who are on the fence about whether or not they want radiation. And I'm going to ask them to do this ACE score and score themselves. And if they score higher than 4, I think on the basis of what I'm pulling together here, we should be recommending that they not skip the radiation, even if it scares them, because they're going to be the people that have the highest benefit. Wouldn't it be great to do a proactive study on cancer, looking at watchful waiting in prostate cancer and adverse childhood events? I'm betting that if you had very few, you'd do very well with conservative management of your cancer, but I'm betting. I don't know it, and I'm not going to advise people. I might risk myself on a bet, but I'm not risking my patients. So what's going on here? Well, we mentioned that the women had the women with adverse childhood experiences had changes in their functioning. Exactly what are we looking at? This study looked at something called the cortisol-releasing hormone receptor gene, and they looked at in the development of depression in adults after childhood trauma. They had a big group of people, and they looked at, what was interesting is that in men in particular, there was a decreased response to a cortisol test called a dexamethasone cortisol-releasing hormone test. In women, there didn't seem to be a difference. In men, there was also a difference in their waking cortisol levels. But in women, there were not. We also saw that there was a gene variant in this study that seemed to make the men less vulnerable to their abuse. And one little side detail of this study, which may or may not have anything to do with the findings, because there's other sexual things that make men and women a little bit different hormonally, but they found that most of the abuse that the men received in their study was physical, and the majority of women who had suffered from abuse had suffered from sexual abuse. So it's even possible that the type of abuse may affect the response of the genes. So certain gene variants may make you less vulnerable. Others may make you more vulnerable. So now we're getting stuff that's inherited. We're getting stuff that's environmentally acquired. And they're both having effect on disease survival. This next study was very interesting because it didn't look at cancer. It looked at people with fibromyalgia. Fibromyalgia is a very common chronic pain syndrome, not well understood, but currently framed as an increase in the brain's sensitivity to pain that feeds back on the body and creates problems with knots and tangles in the muscle. So it's sort of a spine central nervous system heightened sensitivity leading to a spinal reflex arc that causes tightened muscles and tender nodules. Subjects with fibromyalgia in this study completed reports of childhood, physical, and emotional abuse, as well as neglect, and major life events and current perceptions of stress and depression were assessed. And they did a study using salivary cortisol. Now, cortisol is a tricky thing to measure. The difference between lying down and standing up will actually change your cortisol levels, and you have to run it right away. So when you try to draw cortisol in blood, it's very, very problematic. Most of you may know that there's a spike of cortisol in the morning. This is called the waking response. And then there's a sort of ski slope deterioration of the levels of cortisol, such that by 4 hours after waking, it's about half what it was when you were awake. And in another 4 hours, it's dropped by another half. So I think of it as a ski slope when I visualize it. And that's kind of what it looks like when you do a cortisol salivary curve, because you check spit every 4 hours. And so you catch 4 data points and you can literally connect the dots and see whether the body is behaving normal. Normally, you would see a nice smooth curve. When you see a spike in the afternoon, those are often people who are going to have problems sleeping. Childhood physical abuse predicted a flattened diurnal cortisol rhythm. In other words, you didn't get as big a spike, and it just sort of stayed flat. It didn't drop as much. You also saw a greater cortisol response to awakening. People with sexual abuse had a increased cortisol awakening response either. And I've run a lot of these tests on patients over the years. And when people come in with insomnia, if there's any history of physical or childhood abuse, you're often going to see a lot of spikes, and you're going to see a spike of cortisol at the wrong time, which interferes with sleep. Now, it's a chicken and the egg situation, but if these erratic behavior on the cortisol continues for a long time, you start to see increased risk of diseases. Here's one: diurnal cortisol rhythm as a predictor of lung cancer survival. This study looked at cortisol curves. They collected it for 2 days running. They collected the cortisol slope and the cortisol awakening response, just as I've described. They also looked at lymphocyte numbers and subsets, and they monitored survival. So if you had a bad diurnal cortisol slope, that was a predictor of poor survival. The flatter you were, the higher your early mortality. So if you had big spikes, you could have early mortality because that's not normal. And if you had a flat curve, you had early mortality as well. If you had a good curve with a normal slope, even despite controlling for all of the normal things that we would think would be related to cortisol curve, like the white blood cell count and the inflammatory markers, this change in, from normal of the cortisol curve was predictive of a shortened survival curve. So I want to take just a moment and talk about psychoneuroimmunology. This is a field that is emerging that I think is going to prove to be extremely important. And, you know, if we want to lower the rate of cancer death, we need to do exactly what they're talking about with the policing. We need to do it differently. Rather than spending millions and hundreds of millions of dollars built, you know, in investing in new drugs, which are going to be hugely expensive and have, you know, some of these new cancer drugs have pretty drastic side effects and can even cause a cytokine storm in an individual by overstimulating the immune system. So we don't really know how to drive that yet. And if we took 10% of the research money and we went and we found people with early adverse childhood events and we gave them simple therapy, especially the children, if we got the children some decent therapy and taught them to trust the universe while they were still young, those methylation changes go away. They are reversible. You can unlearn a bad habit and you can unlearn fear and suspicion of the universe. You can learn to trust. And somehow learning to trust lowers your cancer rate, improves your cortisol curve, reduces your risk for fibromyalgia, and probably the 10,000 other diseases that we don't have good treatments for could be treated by simply improving the psychological status of the individual in childhood, rescuing them from those adverse events. Many years ago, I ran into a guy who was a reformed cancer surgeon. His name was Bernie Siegel, and he wrote a number of books about using guided imagery and guided visualization to reduce your stress levels and maybe even see your immune cells killing your cancer and taking away the metastases. And he worked with people, and his data, and he did publish actual data, was good. But of course, it's hard to do a control for guided visualization. So the studies never really had they had usual care, but they really couldn't have a placebo. So people knew they were doing something extra, and somehow that activated something in their brain, which shouldn't let you dismiss the data. Well, that was a long time ago, early 80s, mid to late 80s. I'm sorry. I don't remember if I was still in training. But the point is, this has really become a big deal starting from about 2002. The NIH started convening experts and putting together forums and looking at how thought, how psychology affected the cellular and the humoral immune response, and made a huge difference in the DNA. And this is before we had finished the Human Genome Project, and we didn't even know about this methylation thing. We didn't understand the mechanism, but there's a ton of evidence and a ton of research that got funded because they finally started taking the mind-body connection seriously. And boy, am I glad they did. Our first email comes from Jacqueline in Santa Cruz. So penicillin in labor for group B positive is the topic. With regards to getting treated with an antibiotic during my labor, which is coming any day now, I'd like to get your input. What is your gut instinct for this preventative treatment? Let's assume there won't be any risk factors present prior to labor, such as signs of infection, fever, water broke early, as they list here. I've debated the pros and cons. I've informed myself that I'd really like to hear whether the risks outweigh the benefits for this in your view. So first of all, folks, what are we talking about? Group B strep is a bacteria common skin bacteria, commonly found in the female vagina. But if you get born through a vagina that has group B strep in it, you can get colonized or even affected. The rate of colonization is fairly high. In some studies, it's as high as 50% of the, if a woman does not take antibiotics while she's in labor, 50% of the babies will be colonized, and about 1 in 200 will develop group beta strep disease. And you can get early disease, or you can get late disease, and late disease can occur several months after, let's see, the birth. And so it's something that we don't like to see because it can be a very, very serious problem. The infection can cause meningitis. It can cause brain damage. The death rate from group B strep is relatively low, but the infants have long stays in the intensive care unit and probably long courses of antibiotics, causing much more damage to their microbiome. And 45% of infants who get the meningitis will end up, that's 44%, will end up with some developmental disabilities. Some will even have a seizure disorder, vision or hearing loss, microbrain. These are really serious long-term issues. And even if a woman has no risk factors, you've got to look at the odds. Now, the risk of the baby getting sick if you take the antibiotics is about 1 in 4,000. The risk of the baby getting sick, as we've said, if you don't take the antibiotics, is 20 times greater at 1 in 200. So do you really want to go there? And the article that Jacqueline sent, which was a very well thought out critique and analysis, spent a lot of time looking at some of the studies that had criticized the use of it, of the antibiotics proactively. And I thought that you have to understand what the Cochrane collaboration is. It's very nitpicky science, and they assign value to studies based on criteria like, is there a placebo? Now, obviously, there's women who don't get to the hospital in time to get the IV antibiotics. So, you know, that's your non-treatment group. But it's not, that's obviously a circumstance that might occur for other reasons that could affect outcome. Nevertheless, we don't have to worry about whether the baby got GBS or not. We can culture it off of them. So it is a preventative, and I don't think the research that would require to prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt, according to the Cochrane collection, is ethical. And I believe that the CDC has made a good selection here. Now, of course, I worry about the microbiome with antibiotics. And so what I found most useful, Jacqueline, here, was looking at what we know about just a single dose of IV antibiotic during labor. It temporarily, it does impact the microbiome. The best study was a large Canadian study, as you know, but I'm sharing this with our audience. So there were groups of children who got antibiotic exposure with a vaginal birth, or they got antibiotic exposure with elective cesarean or antibiotic exposure with unplanned cesarean. And of course, they used a different antibiotic during the cesareans. But all of the infants exposed during labor or birth had decreased levels of bacteroidetes, which is an important beneficial bacteria in childhood, and they had a decrease in diversity of their microbiome. But the ones who were breastfed for at least 3 months did a lot better. As we'd expect, the most severe changes in the microbiome happened in babies who were born by cesarean, and they had a lot of levels of bacteria that you wouldn't see in a healthy infant microbiome. But by 1 year of age, all of those changes were pretty much gone. Still a little residual in the babies who were born by unplanned cesarean, who had not been breastfed for the 3 months. So what's the take-home here? The take-home is a 1 in 4,000 chance of getting infected with a 50% chance of brain damage if you do, brain damage or death if you do, versus 1 in 200 of having that risk, it's a no-brainer. You have to take the antibiotics. I'm going to put in a protocol for a company called Claire, K-L-A-I-R-E, a little pitch for them, because they have a very good infant probiotic. And this has been my baby shower present for about the last 5 years since I came across this product. I basically gift the mother with a supply of baby probiotic because it's got the ones that the baby should be getting from the breastfeeding. But there's nothing wrong with an extra dose here, folks. In fact, it's probably a great idea. This stuff has been around for almost a decade, and there are no reports of harm, injury, infection, increased diarrhea, blah, 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 whatever you can think of. It doesn't seem to hurt the children, and I'm convinced it might be very helpful. So that's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it. So let's go to our next email, and this one from Dan in Monterey. Low-dose naltrexone. I just listened to your podcast of 527, and yes, I got a case of warm fuzzies upon hearing that LDN may help your patients with chronic pain. You mentioned that you intended to send me some links to LDN and neuropathy that I could share with my doctor, but as of today, none have arrived. That was on June 6th. Dan, I am sorry. I think I did that, but I will definitely pull that out and send it to you if I don't find it in my sent folder. Pretty sure it just took me a few days to do it. I'm in the idiopathic category of peripheral neuropathy, which is probably not helpful. Do you think acupuncture in combination with LDN would be effective for me? I used to listen to your Saturday program on KUSP while out running back in, I want to say, the previous century. Is that even possible? Looking forward to receiving the links. Yes, we started there in 1998, and for my sins, I've been on radio in the Monterey Bay area continuously. I think a six-month break since 1993. I really love doing radio. I love doing patient education. And I'm starting to move up to doing video presentations on YouTube. So I want to remind people you can go to AskDrDawn.com and link to those. And we're working on another one using some of last week's show on vaccinations, but putting it together with some slides, because I think in the next year or so, understanding how vaccinations work and how they're made is kind of going to be a hot topic. So let's provide some good information and not some crazy information about it. So getting back to Dan, most peripheral neuropathy is in fact idiopathic, with the exception of diabetes. So the first thing I do when presented with a new case is I always look, I screen for hobbies. Does this person solder? Do they paint with paints that might have cadmium? Are they a ceramic artist? Are they on a well? Could they have heavy metal exposures? And I go looking for those. Do they eat a lot of rice? Well, then I want to check for arsenic. All of these are potent neurotoxins. Also, I check them for the MTHFR mutation. This is a mutation that many people have, and it interferes with your ability to process folic acid. It can also be accompanied by a mutation in the ability to process B12. And I've found a lot of quote-unquote idiopathic peripheral neuropathy cases in people having those mutations, which is MTHFR and MTRR, or people with exposure to heavy metals. So I always go looking for those because those are things that we have treatments for that can reduce the risk of progression. Another thing that's been shown to reduce the risk of progression of peripheral neuropathy, and in some cases reverse it, are very high doses of methylated B12, methylated folate, CoQ10, and we're talking big doses, like thousands of milligrams of CoQ10, so this isn't a cheap treatment, and something called alpha-lipoic acid at about 600 milligrams a day. And there is at least one published study, and I'm sorry, I don't have the reference to send you on that one, but it showed a regression of pain scores in people who were taking that. I've found acupuncture to be successful about 50% of the time for distal peripheral neuropathy of the feet. And so often I have a significant reduction in symptoms, but I don't get them all gone. But about 50% of the time, I can get people on a maintenance program of maybe one treatment every 2 to 3 months. And I think that's quite reasonable and affordable for most of us, and very effective for something that otherwise you're just taking a lot of gabapentin. Certainly, you should consider taking low-dose naltrexone, and I'd be happy to see you for acupuncture. I just refer you to the Ask Dr. Dawn website, where you can link to my practice. Let's go to our next email, and this from John in St. Louis. So, out of state, one of our podcast listeners. John in St. Louis writes, seed oils. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I'm a licensed acupuncturist who loves your show and trusts your advice greatly. An author here is publishing information on how harmful seed oils are to our health. I searched your archive and couldn't find a discussion on the topic. I'm curious if you agree and think we should try to eliminate these seed oils completely. Since learning about this, we've been astonished to find they are in almost every processed item at Whole Foods, from crackers to frozen foods and more. Here's the link to the author who is sounding the alarm about these. Thanks so much for your show. So this gave us a link to a drkate.com, and he or she is talking about the Hateful Eight. Very catchy. And actually, John, there's a lot on my website about this, but it's not using seed oils as the topic. It's actually talking about omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids versus omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids. And just to recap, these are oils that have some double bonds. I don't know how many of you remember from chemistry, but you can either have one bond connecting two atoms, or you can have two, or sometimes even three, but that tends to be a very bad situation when you have three. But two, not so unusual. These cause effectively a loss of, it's like a kink in a chain. The fatty acid at that double bond can't rotate around itself. Good analogy would be Tinker Toys. Remember Tinker Toys? Basically, little discs with holes in them and you stuck sticks in. And with one stick holding two discs together, you can spin the disc. But if you put two sticks through two adjacent holes, that thing's not going to rotate. And that's exactly what's going on molecularly. So with the polyunsaturated fatty acids, the big difference is, where's that first double bond? Is it at the omega-3 position, or is it at the omega-6 position? And you find both omega-3 and omega-6 oils in nature, but the omega-6s are found in higher amounts in the ocean, in sea vegetables, in obviously in fish, and in green leafy plants. The omega-3s are found in higher percentage in seeds. And for most of our history as entities on the planet, our omega-3 to omega-6 ratio in our diet, allowing for seeds and leafy greens and meat and fish, was around 2 to 4 to 1, depending on how much fish you ate. So about twice as much omega-3 as omega-6. But then what happened was in the Industrial Revolution. And during the Industrial Revolution, we invented hydraulic presses. And we discovered that we could press seeds and get oil. And remember, this is back in whaling days. Oil was an expensive commodity. Being able to take something that was relatively cheap and squeeze it makes a big difference. And there's a fairly misleading graph here that is in Dr. Kate's website, which shows a correlation between diabetes and prediabetes and the introduction of seed oils. This is possibly true historically, but the cause and effect is missing. And I really feel that the data doesn't support the assertion that's being made as far as why diabetes might be caused by seed oils. I really don't think you can support that implied assertion. What I do think you can support is the connection between the omega-3 fatty acids and inflammation. You've probably heard of prostaglandin. You've certainly heard of ibuprofen and Motrin and Advil and Nuprin. And you get the idea. There's a whole class of drugs out there whose job it is to slow down the production of prostaglandins, because prostaglandins are largely the signaling for the pain and the inflammation of disease. So you want to keep your prostaglandin levels at a happy medium where they can do the job that they're supposed to do. And when you do injure yourself, they're a side effect of the injury, and it's debatable whether they're necessary. Once you get that initial flare, you probably don't need them to persist. However, they're going to persist for a while because you just turned on some DNA and made some enzyme, and it's chewing through the cell wall and grabbing arachidonic acid and turning it into prostaglandin. Now, if the cell wall has a lot of omega-6 instead of a lot of omega-3, arachidonic acid is an omega-3, then you still make prostaglandins with the omega-6, but because of the kink being in a different place, these prostaglandins are substantially less inflammatory. Let me say that again. The prostaglandins that you make from omega-6 fatty acids are less inflammatory. They're inflammatory enough, but not so much as the unnatural levels of omega-3 in the processed food diet. So you're absolutely right. The whole foods, any processed food, even quote-unquote health foods, will have these seed oils. And we're talking about things like corn oil, canola oil, soy oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil, grapeseed oil, rice bran oil. These are all high in omega-3. They're all more inflammatory than they need to be, and they set you up for more inflammation. They may even set you up for a higher risk of COVID-19 cytokine storm. That's not clear, and there's an assertion made, a suggestion made in this article, which I also think is kind of pushing the envelope a little bit, but hey, it's an opinion piece, really, not an educational one. But Dr. Kate, who my producer informs me is a woman, go girl, is making a really important point, and I think one that's probably lost on a lot of doctors. When you go into the intensive care unit for any reason, you're not eating, especially if you're on a ventilator. You're getting some sugar in your veins, and your body starts to cannibalize itself, and it'll start to go into its fat supply and burn it. Well, when you do that, you're releasing into your bloodstream these omega-3s, and some of them are going to readily be converted to prostaglandins. So you're increasing, potentially, the immune system's reaction in a bad way. We don't want high levels of polyunsaturated fatty acids that are omega-3s. So we've got to get back to something more like that 2-4 ratio that we were talking about before. And I hope that as you think about eating now that you've been down in isolation, or at least shut down, you've learned to cook. And I really hope that you will start making your own salad dressing. Seriously, I have searched high and low, and it is almost impossible to find salad dressing that doesn't use one of these seed oils. Salad dressing, in other words, it's made with olive oil. So that's what you should be making your salad dressing with. Go get some recipes. And even just doing that little bit and maybe reducing the snack foods. You can get a lot of good stuff at the health food store. But, you know, the crackers and the chips and the Frankenfoods, those, they aren't food. They're food-like substances. They're diced and sliced and crumbled and extruded. And, you know, they are a healthier version of an unhealthy thing. And particularly with respect to the fat, they are no healthier. Well, maybe they don't have trans fats, but then that became a hot wire and nobody has trans fats practically anymore. But you can think of this as sort of son of trans fat in terms of the adverse effect on your health. They're not evil, but we have tweaked the ratio to the point where we have created a pro-inflammatory diet in our society, and even the quote-unquote health food store foods are not necessarily healthy in this respect.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.